Connecticut yesterday to meet with grieving families after Friday's horrific massacre. Adam Lanza killed 20 first graders at Sandy Hook Elementary School, as well as the principal, school psychologist, and four teachers. He then turned his gun on himself. He had killed his mother before heading for the school. The president spoke at an interfaith prayer vigil last night and said this.
We gather here in memory of 20 beautiful children and six remarkable adults. They lost their lives in a school that could have been any school, in a quiet town full of good and decent people that could be any town in America. Here in Newtown, I come to offer the love and prayers of a nation. I am very mindful that mere words cannot match the depths of your sorrow, nor can they heal your wounded hearts.
This is the fourth time Mr. Obama has met with victims of mass killing since he's been in office. While this tragedy is shocking, it's also important to realize that many children in the United States have to deal with the daily threat of violence. The president said the country is judged on how it treats the youngest members of society.
Can we honestly say that we're doing enough to keep our children, all of them, safe from harm? Can we claim as a nation that we're all together there, letting them know that they're loved and teaching them to love in return? Can we say that we're truly doing enough to give all the children of this country the chance they deserve to live out their lives in happiness and with purpose? I've been reflecting on this the last few days, and if we're honest with ourselves, the answer is no. We're not doing enough, and we will have to change.
We have three guests who have joined us on Radio Time. Stephen Berkowitz is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and associate professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also director of the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. Stephen Berkowitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is Joel Fine. He's a professor of pediatrics and emergency medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an attending physician in the emergency department of Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's also director of the Philadelphia Collaborative Violence Prevention Center, co-director of the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs, and board chair of the Institute for Safe Families in Philadelphia. Joel Fine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Our third guest is Dorothy Johnson-Spite. She's a licensed family therapist, founder of Mothers in Charge. That's a grassroots organization focusing on violence prevention through education and interventions for children, young adults, and families based here in Philadelphia. She founded this organization following the 2001 murder of her 28-year-old son, colleague Jabbar Johnson, over a parking space grievance. And Dorothy, it's always a pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Stephen Berkowitz, let me begin with you and Joel Fine. And frankly, I'd like to hear from all of you and, of course, our listeners as well. Last night I was watching the president's speech and the vigil, seeing that a lot of children in that audience were given stuffed animals to hold. I know that their funerals starting today. There will be funerals all week. And I'm thinking of those children in those classrooms who survived, who lost friends, who lost classmates, perhaps even some who lost siblings. What do these youngsters need?
A lot. One thing to recognize is that it's not just the child's trauma. It's a family trauma, and it's a community trauma. So that these children are at the epicenter, but all are involved and all are affected. And the best thing that we can do is to provide ongoing support from friends and family and others. We know that that actually helps people recover from these events. And also ongoing monitoring and professional support when needed. And these children, particularly the ones who were at the school, will need professional intervention. And fortunately, that they're getting it now.
To you, Joel, same question about what does that support look like? And I realize each one of these children and their families are different.
Right. I think it also depends on the age of the child, their developmental level. I think there are some key factors, though, and I think what Steve was saying is that we need to help train, really, everyone from parents, first-line workers, anyone who's going to be a touch point for these children and families on how to handle this. It's easy to avoid it because you just don't know what to do, or it's even easier to say the wrong thing. That is that's really important, and it starts with even in the emergency setting, even the EMS providers and police that are connecting with the kids initially and helping the families through.
And what do you suggest that people do? I can imagine all the things that you shouldn't do, but what should you do, or what are several things to keep in mind?
Well, I think it's important to make sure that they know, first and foremost, that they're safe at the point that you're seeing them. And not only are they safe from what event has just occurred, but that they're also safe in your hands. In the hospital setting, I think it can be very scary. And so even in an ambulance or afterwards, and I think that understanding what that child has been through, what they need to know, how they need to be prepared, and how they need to understand what is going to happen from here on is important. They also need to know that there is one person that they can go to at that point in time that's a safe and consistent person. So the sense of connectedness, even if their parent has been injured or is not right then and there, they have to be kind of assigned to that one
person. So this is their person.
This is their person, and they're going to be looking for that person. And different age kids will respond differently, but they all need a secure individual.
Dorothy, let me turn to you. And I have to say, over the weekend, since you've been on the show several times, frankly, sadly, talking about situations like this, I'm thinking about what families need and what parents need as they go through this extraordinarily difficult time.
Yeah, I think it's important that they seek help, professional help oftentimes, depending, of course, on the circumstances of the particular loss. With children especially, I think adults often think that it's okay for them to just, you know, not be included in the conversation, that maybe they're too young or they don't understand. But oftentimes, I think it's important that they have open conversations and dialogue with children about, and be honest as you can, depending, of course, on the developmental age of the child, but to have real conversation about grief and loss and things like that, because what they don't get a chance to discuss, they will make up in their head, you know, or will cause oftentimes fear because they don't know. So I think it's important that there's conversation. Sometimes adults will say, well, just go outside and play and it'll be okay, and not want to discuss certain issues around children. But I think it's important that on some level you do have, you know, honest dialogue with them and as much as possible to help them to feel safe.
Stephen, let me go back to you, and I think like everyone this weekend, I was, you know, riveted to reading as many things as I possibly could to try to figure out, to try to frankly comprehend what happened. And I have so many unanswered questions, I think, like most people, including what motivated this young man to go to this school to shoot 20 first graders, 6 and 7 year old children. Do you have an answer? I mean, I'm not looking for an answer, but I'm curious about how you are struggling with that.
I think we're all struggling to make sense out of the senseless.
Yeah.
And
it's incomprehensible.
It's completely incomprehensible. So we don't know a lot about this gentleman, and I think it's probably not a good idea to speculate. However, what we do know is that there were very clear signs of mental illness.
And you can say that just from the outside?
I can say that from the outside.
Okay.
And I think that has been clear in most of the mass shootings that we know about. And it begs the question, I think, which the president did touch upon, why is it so hard to access and receive the appropriate behavioral mental health care that so many people need? And that the combination of psychiatric disturbance and access to automatic weapons, we have seen time and time again, is not only lethal, it's mass lethality.
Let me go back to you, Joel Fine, and just picking up on what Stephen Berkowitz was saying, but are we talking about stigma associated with seeking help, or the fact that we don't have the right kind of help, or that schools are cutting back and they don't have counselors, or we have a healthcare system that makes it very difficult to get the kind of mental health services that he's talking about?
So the answer to that is yes.
Yes. Okay.
And I think that Dorothy mentioned a plea for people to seek help. It is sometimes a struggle to engage families and children into mental health care just from the perspective that they feel like it's a weakness, and it's something that weakness is not supposed to be shown. In certain cultures, that's very, very important. In our society, the access issues and the health care finance issues also come into play. I think that, you know, from a physician's perspective, in the especially in the acute care setting, we can do a pretty good job of stabilizing kids and even older kids that need the help. The question is, what's the ongoing care? What's right. the what's
Once
the recognition
the
that the family needs as much support as that child in order to make this a successful intervention?
And I agree that the family and the parents need as much help as the child, because oftentimes I think parents suffer in shame. They are not willing to seek the help and support for their children because there's so much shame, I think, or attached to mental health. Like, my kid is crazy and there's something wrong with me because he's crazy. You know, I mean, that's the kind of things that you hear. And it's shame, because mental health is just like any other illness. You've got to seek the help and support that you need in order to get better. And I think parents suffer with that shame piece and oftentimes won't get the help. And I think especially in the African-American community, you know, seeking help or seeing a psychologist for many years, it's different now, but for many years it was definitely taboo. You know, you may talk to your minister or your pastor about, you know, some things, but you don't talk to anybody else outside of your family.
I would also think, and if this is too sensitive, tell me, but I would also think that parents believe, whether it's true or not, that they can protect their children.
Well, that's what we're putting on earth to do.
Well, exactly.
That's what
exactly.
we believe.
And if you feel like I could not protect my child.
And when that doesn't happen, it's so much attached to that, so much guilt, so much pain that the parents live with, whether it's a homicide or whether it's the mental health of a particular child of yours. So I think there are signs very early on that parents should not ignore, you know, certain types of behaviors. I think it was even brought out with this particular person, Adam, that his mother said there's two brothers. So one, you know, he can play and kind of do what he wants, but keep an eye on Adam. Mm-hmm. So very early on, clearly she knew that there was something wrong, but I don't know to what degree, and we don't know all of the details, but I think a lot of times parents are just shameful.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about, frankly, what the country is talking about today. And, of course, the mass shootings in a small town, Newtown, Connecticut, over the weekend on Friday. 20 children, ages 6 and 7, 6 educators at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, were killed. The shooter killed himself, apparently killed his mother before he went to this school. Talking with Dorothy Johnson Spite, whose voice you just heard, Joel Fine and Stephen Berkowitz. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Please Touch Museum at Memorial Hall in Fairmount Park, the Children's Museum of Philadelphia, supports WHYY. Please Touch Museum offers 2 floors of interactive exhibit space, daily theater shows, an historic carousel, and more. Extended holiday hours December 23rd through 29th. Closed on Christmas Day. Please Touch Museum is conveniently located off I-76 and features on-site parking. PleaseTouchMuseum.org or 215-581-3181.
A Christmas tradition continues as Chris Cetullo and Tony Auth present their annual holiday radio play. Enjoy a sneak preview of Certain Poor Shepherds here at WHYY Tuesday, December 20th, before it airs. See the illustrations and hear the inside story from Chris and Tony. Certain Poor Shepherds comes to WHYY-FM and Newsworks.org December 23rd, but you can enjoy it early and meet the creators at a Newsworks Christmas. RSVP at WHYY.org/events.
It's that time of year. Time to set out the cookies and milk and wait for our very own Kris Kringle, Andy Serzan, who's going to drop by the studio with his own mix of holiday musical treasures.
Andy's the man with a bag full of Christmas rarities, and this year he's exploring Santa's soulful side.
It's Christmas!
Join us this week on Sound Opinions for a special soul edition of our holiday spectacular.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Dorothy Johnson-Spite, a licensed family therapist, founder of Mothers in Charge, an organization here in Philadelphia. Joel Fine, professor of pediatrics and emergency medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also an attending physician in the ER department at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He has several other organizations he's involved in, including director of the Philadelphia Collaborative Violence Prevention Center. Also with us, Stephen Burke, a child and adolescent psychiatrist and associate professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's director of the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. Let me get, looks like Terry from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Terry, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know if anybody here can speak to this directly, but I'm very curious about what transpires in, say, the first 30 minutes following this. You know, our conversation is a little bit about follow-up and aftercare, but literally the kids are taken in this instance to the local, I think it was, fire department parking lot for parents to pick them up. And I really, like, seriously, I'm not kidding, like, does somebody hand out lorazepam tablets for, you know, anti-anxiety drugs? And just, you know, what actually happened?
Well, let's find out. Let's find out, Terry, and I'm going to toss that to Stephen Berkowitz.
So one of the most important things to do is what they did, which is to connect children with their caregivers and loved ones. That's probably the first intervention, and that's the most appropriate intervention. Medications are contraindicated. You don't use them acutely. In fact, there are studies that show that using benzodiazepines actually worsen outcomes. The key piece is to create a sense of safety, and that's why law enforcement and others are so important. They are the messengers of safety, and support from professionals to law enforcement and others at those acute moments. There is a model called psychological first aid that was developed by the National Center for PTSD and the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which is an excellent guideline, and it is being implemented in Connecticut now and has been across the country since actually Katrina. And it's really a collaborative, multi-step stabilization model.
I have to say, and we were talking about this before going on the air, I'll put this to you, Joel Fine, which was the fact that the spokespeople over the weekend, I thought, did an extraordinary job of keeping us informed, of trying not to, you know, go off on tangents. You could hear questions from the reporters there, but and also being very aware that we're talking about grieving traumatized families.
I do. I think that they have been doing as good a job as possible. I think that in general, the sense of calmness that needs to occur, especially in that first phase, has got to be promoted, and they did a wonderful job of doing that. It's also a matter of providing some sense of structure for the families and the kids. This is what is happening now. This is what's going to happen next. And that is, in a sense, going to calm everybody and help them through the process.
Let's talk about the media coverage. It's been pretty much wall-to-wall on a lot of television stations. I'm not sure who to go to first, but let me toss it back to you, Stephen. How did the media do? What should the perhaps this is the advantage of hindsight. If we could roll back the clock to, you know, Friday at 9 o'clock, what should the media have done?
Well, I have, unfortunately, more experience than I want to admit in dealing with these situations and dealing with the media in situations like this. And I think the media can be a crucial part of a response. But they also have they have other jobs to do, which is to sell their market share. And I think one of the first things that we need to do is get the media together and ask them how they can be proponents of healing. One way not to do it is to rush in with microphones, shove them in grieving adults, children's faces, and essentially interview them and ask them to relive what they just experienced.
Shortly after they had just experienced it.
Right. That is just not the right thing to do, and it's unfortunate when things are so chaotic that that's exactly what happens. The media could be a real help, and I think that some are, and there's an organization called DART, which is a wonderful a group of journalists who work with trauma specialists in order to help their colleagues think about these kinds of issues.
You want to add to that, Joel Fine?
No, I agree with Steve. I think that you know that it's important to provide information. I think it's not just it is the direct families that are grieving and the community that's grieving, but it's also the nation that's grieving. And I think providing information at all levels is important, and it keeps what Dorothy was saying, people from fantasizing about the worst, you know, wrong things, and keeps them informed. That's key. Uh-huh. But to put a microphone in front of a child,
which we saw.
We saw that happen.
We saw that.
Is probably not the best idea. I don't know how that occurred or what it transpired before then. And on the flip side, people do feel like they need to do something, and giving someone a microphone is giving them some power to do something. And so in a sense of the efficacy of what can I do to make this better, mm-hmm. people will take that microphone. And sometimes, you know, you'd think, why would somebody want to do that? That's probably why.
Yeah. Let me make a segue here, and this is not to either belittle or in any way minimize what happened in Connecticut, Newtown, Connecticut. But I want to turn to you, Dorothy, because we also are in a city where there's high level of violence. We've done numerous shows on this show about neighborhoods in the city where there is the almost daily sound of gunfire. Children afraid to go to school, families afraid to let their children play outside. Do you see parallels?
I do.
The president kind of referenced this very obliquely last night, but
I do. And I just, first of all, want to say that my heart has been aching, you know, since Friday over this tragedy. You know, 20 children murdered is horrible. And I know that pain. I know it personally. I know what each and every one of those parents are going to have to live with for the rest of their life, not just over the next couple of weeks while the media covers it, but from now until. So I understand that pain. But I also understand the pain of each and every family that comes to our office, who calls our phone, who has lost a child to violence. It's the same kind of pain. Unfortunately, it doesn't get the same type of coverage. You know,
because it's almost an everyday
It's an everyday. I was in Atlanta, Georgia, last week because we're actually forming a national coalition of organizations and families across this country who've been affected by violence. And there was, while I was there, a two-year-old, Tiana Moley, who was killed while sleeping in her home. A stray bullet came into her home and killed her and shot her little brother. I think he was 5. So the mother lost one child to violence and another one was seriously injured. Didn't make the news. You don't hear about those stories. But that mother's grief is no different from the grief of the mothers and families in Connecticut or from the mothers in Philadelphia or Chicago or anywhere across this nation where this level of violence is happening every single day. And you're right, the president did allude to it last night, that all children must be kept safe.
Right, deserve our protection. Yes. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dorothy Johnson Spite. Also with us, Joel Fine, Stephen Berkowitz, talking about the tragic shooting in Newtown, Connecticut on Friday. Last night there was a prayer vigil. And, of course, this tragedy has opened up a conversation. We don't know if it's going to result in any changes in laws or regulations, but it's the topic for our conversation. And, again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Joel, though, let me go back to you because it must also be said that we had a principal, a psychologist who tried to stop this shooter and ended up being shot and killed. We heard about teachers in classrooms trying to protect children, thinking on their feet, some of whom lost their lives. I'm thinking of the first responders going to that school, and I can't imagine what they saw in those classrooms, but there are, as much as we have this horrific murder to talk about, series of murders to talk about, we have, on the other side, these extraordinary acts of courage and caring.
Marnie, I think that's really important to recognize. one of the techniques that we may consider as kids are watching this on television, because they, you know, even though we can shut our TVs off, they're hearing it in school, they're seeing it in other places. The media is very hard to keep out of our children's hands. Is a message of not look what bad thing happened, which of course they're already digesting, but look how many people are helping. Look at all the helpers here. Look at all the people that are trying to keep others safe. And that is one small message that can get across in that quest that Steve mentioned to try and keep those kids feeling safe and those families feeling safe.
What do you hope happens as a result of this, Stephen?
I hope that the families, not only in Connecticut, but across the country, and those that Dorothy talked about, get the kind of attention and support that they need, that we recognize what an endemic it is in this country, and that it's really, truly a problem that we need to address. That there are good interventions between the likes of we academics and therapists and grassroots organizations that can really be helpful to people. And I hope that there is a real, true national conversation about, as Dorothy put it, that mental health is just as much a disease as any other illness, as well as the issues of why do we have such ready access to such dangerous weapons, and how can they get in the hands of people who have clear disturbances.
What about for you, Dorothy?
Yeah, I agree with that. Agree with Stephen. Mental health is something that we need to really get education on. And I know here Dr. Arthur Evans, who is the Commissioner of Behavioral Health, has done a lot to educate our community on mental health with different seminars and things like that. I think it needs to be more of that. I'd like to see that come out of this, that we begin to educate families, and that it shouldn't be a taboo if you need help or support, that that should be encouraged. And I think we'll see less. And so many people are on the, you know, there's so many different platforms. Of course, there's the illegal guns and too many guns and the assault weapons. And I agree that, you know, there are too many guns in our communities, you know, and in the hands of wrong folks. So I think that that is something that needs to be addressed as well.
Go ahead, Joel.
I also think that we should recognize that mental health is not just the absence of mental illness, and that all the events that are occurring in our communities that Dorothy was mentioning, especially, you know, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, anywhere in the country, there is a stress associated with living in those situations that cannot be ignored. And the AAP has just come out with a statement on toxic stress. And one of the ways that our children suffer through that is by living in fear.
Wow.
And not being able to go to school and learn. And not because the schools have their own issues with being able to teach in those settings, but it's the kids who are not ready physiologically to absorb information and to be there because they just are so heightened in their awareness of issues of danger.
And by toxic stress, you mean just living with high levels of chronic stress?
Yes.
I've seen young people, and we do a lot of work with young people in the community, 10-year-olds who can tell you the type of gun by the sound of the gun.
Mm. Yes.
Because they hear so much of the gunfire at night in their communities that they know what kind of gun it is by the sound. A 10-year-old. So that in itself will cause all the things that you've talked about for a young child to live with. How can they ever realize their full potential or be all that they can be when they live in situations like that?
Go ahead, Stephen, then we'll get back to our callers.
And I think it's a very important point. And one of the things that we need to talk about is the cycle of violence. That these children who grow up constantly being endangered, one of the most obvious responses is to do it to them before they do it to me. And I think that's one of the cycles that we continue to see in our society.
I want to pick up on that. Let me get, looks like Chris from Haddonfield to join our conversation. And Chris, go ahead.
Hello, Steve.
Hi, you're on Radio Times, Chris.
Let me close the phone. Let me answer that phone real quick.
Okay, let's Well, I'm not sure. We're somehow not connected with Chris from Haddonfield. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Well, let's talk about guns and even the fact, as I was doing some reading over the weekend, looking at some of these mass shootings, not the individual shootings, but these mass shootings, and we've had a lot of them in the last couple of decades, something like 80% of those guns were bought legally, mm-hmm. and including what we know about Lanza, his mother had guns, and apparently they were bought legally. This is different from the problems of illegal guns being sold in Philadelphia, for instance, but in certain ways we're talking about legally owned guns. How do you wrestle with that, Stephen?
All the time. Mm-hmm. My feeling is that there are guns and there are guns, and that automatic weapons have no other purpose than to kill a lot of people, and that I have nothing against hunting, nothing against revolvers, but I don't see the need for citizens to have automatic weapons on the street. So I think that's one way to wrestle with it. And that we have all these loopholes in our gun laws, the gun shows without checks, so on and so forth. So you can buy guns legally, sort of. And I think that's a huge issue.
What do you think, Dorothy?
I agree. And it's not to take anything away from gun owners who are responsible gun owners. But oftentimes when guns fall into the hands of, criminals or folks with mental health issues, that becomes a problem for all of us. Right. And so I think there are things, especially in Pennsylvania, that could be different. There's no waiting period. There's no real check, right. On the person who's purchasing this gun. Some states are different, but Pennsylvania, we need to do better. We really do.
I just wanted to add, there is a law that was passed by the legislature in Florida disallowing physicians from asking people about owning guns in their house. Hmm. A crucial aspect of trying to understand safety and risk.
Right. And just underscore that something like 30,000 deaths every year from firearms, but I think one-third from homicides, one-third from suicides, one-third from accidents.
That's correct.
Mm. Go ahead.
So I think Steve brings up a good point. The understanding that this is in a public health model, you think about what the vector is, which of course is the gun, but you also think about the risk factors around those guns. And so pediatricians and family doctors and internists and everyone who's seeing a patient should be allowed to learn what the risk factors in the home are. We ask about bike helmets, we ask about fire safety. These are known risk factors for injury, and it's our job to prevent injury. So the concept of us being intrusive and asking about guns and not being intrusive and asking about anything else is, I think, somewhat absurd. And that law has been shot down in a number of other states where it's been proposed. So I think that we're kind of on the same page around that.
But you know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a break here.
Sure.
And that's Joel Fine joining us along with Dorothy Johnson Spite and Stephen Berkowitz talking about the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. 20 children ages 6 and 7 were killed. 6 educators at the school were killed. The shooter shot himself and apparently had shot his mother before going to the school. We're talking about what this means and what to do about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Camden Redevelopment Agency introduces new housing opportunities in 2 communities near Cooper University Hospital and Rutgers University that enable you to live where you work and play. The new and renovated homes offer energy efficiencies with historic architectural styles. More information at 877-293-2826 or livecamden.org. That's 877-293-2826.
WHYY delivers news you can trust, educational programs kids and parents depend on, and entertainment that keeps everyone smiling. Newsworks.org has you covered with smart, local news. Terry Gross and Marty Moscowane talk to, just about every newsmaker you can think of. Make your tax-deductible gift to WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
Last month, we started a conversation about what it really means to give thanks and how the simple act of caring can help change lives and communities. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, more on the art and science of caring. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Dorothy Johnson Spite, Joel Fine, and Stephen Berkowitz. And I do want to get back to our callers, but Joel, you wanted to say something. I had to interrupt you.
Sure. No, I think that it's important for us to realize that as a community, including the community of medicine, the clergy, and all of the places where families have points of contact, to have this discussion about what it is, what it means to have to own a gun, and what it means as far as Dorothy mentioned, responsible, and you know, personally, I would not let my children when they were younger play in a home where there was a gun. I didn't trust my children at that point, you know. And when one of them can find anything, if you lose it, so he's very good at finding things. I think that you know, asking about behavioral problems. And understanding behavioral problems in children and then mixing it with a vector like a gun doesn't give a chance for us to learn what that child can and cannot be cannot do. So I think that's a really important, we should not be taking away the permission to ask about these things and to figure out what the risks are.
Especially if we think of this as a public health issue.
It is completely a public health issue. There is no greater one in many of our cities than this one.
Let me get, looks like Tina from Philadelphia to join us. And Tina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I want to just preface my question by saying that I'm not one of those parents who wants to have my kid live in a bubble and totally protect him from everything. I mean, I talk to him about things, but he's six. He's a first grader. We went through the whole weekend. He had no idea what happened because he only watches things that are on the DVR, you know, so he didn't know. And I spent the whole weekend being kind of proud of myself that, like, cool, you know, right. He doesn't have to face this.
Right.
And then it occurred to me this morning that he's going to go to school and the whole school may be buzzing about it and he may find out about it fresh without me there to support him. And I don't know. I feel like I screwed up, but I just wondered what your panel sort of thought about, you know, telling that six-year-old when they don't know otherwise.
Well, Tina, I think you called the right place. Let me start with Stephen Berkowitz. Go ahead, Stephen.
So I commend you for not letting your child watch the TV and the news. I think young children are unfortunately inundated by these events. And parents, you know, understandably, they want to know what's going on, and the kids come by and they see what's going on. So I think it's quite admirable that you did what you did.
About the playground today.
The problem, of course, is that they don't live in a bubble, and you can't keep them from everything. And so for a child your child's age, I think the message is, you know, something really horrible happened in Connecticut or in the country. Let me tell you what it was, and I want you to know that you're safe, that my job is to keep you safe, your school is going to keep you safe, and they know how to do that, and we know how to do that. Mm. That's what a child your child's age needs to hear.
Tina, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead, Joel.
And I think when he comes home from school today, just
absolutely
ask him what he thinks first.
Right.
And figure out what he knows and what his concerns are before
jumping.
And what other people said.
Yeah, go ahead, Dorothy.
Marty, you mentioned earlier how, as parents, we think our job is to keep our children safe, and we try and do that, and most of us do a great job of it. This caller just reminds me of, my daughter's 25 now, and when she was 5 years old, so 20 years ago, rap music was just coming on the scene, and I was doing everything I could to protect her from hearing the awful rap music. Rap music, you know. So we don't play it in the home. We don't, you know, we don't listen to it. And one day she came home from school and she was going to a private school, you know, struggling to keep her in private. She comes home singing this rap music. I'm thinking, my God, what, you know? The bus driver on the bus that took her to and from school every day had a little transistor radio that she played this music. I'm thinking, oh my God, I've done all I could to protect her from hearing this music, and now she knows all the words. You know, so we do the best we can, and we pray.
It was very short time that it took when I realized that there's someone else putting ingredients in my soup.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Right, you think you're totally in control of that soup, and you're not. Let's see what, thanks for the call, Tina. Let's see what looks like Natalie from Lahaska has to say. Natalie, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I was just wondering about the long-term effects on the town itself. I didn't grow up in a small town, but I lived in one for a few years, and I had two jobs in the town, and I knew everybody, and I keep thinking about how even a year, 2 years, would affect everything, the economy, you know, people, everything from people going out to eat to the sports, the recreational activities. Because every single person is somehow connected to one of those kids, if not more of those kids. And if anyone on the panel has seen, you know, after it's all off the media, no one's talking about it anymore. What's going on in these towns?
Well, I'm actually going to toss that to Dorothy, even though you don't live in a small town. You live here in Philadelphia, certainly the area. But I think there's some parallels to some of the urban communities that have had to deal with.
Yeah, and I don't think that anything like this ever goes away quickly. But I think the goal should be at some point to focus on the strength of that community and to talk about and to look at and to find ways to bring the community together in a way that it strengthens and uplifts one another, each other, you know, and find ways to really become a stronger community as a result of this tragedy.
Joel, going back to you, and you talked about certainly that first point of contact, but if a child is struggling with perhaps something they have observed or a deep loss, what, let's say after a month or two or three or four, what are some of the signs they might exhibit?
I think that, you know, the signs can be varied, and it depends on the age of the child and that child's personality. The way that the family itself communicates it usually sets, there's a culture of communication in every family that may be a little bit different. I think that play is a very important role for younger children. For older children and adolescents, there's anxiety, depression, all the things that manifest more like adults do, but their role maybe to figure out how they can help prevent this. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's the sense of efficacy that I think can be given to older children. And they will come up with ideas. Whether those ideas are the same as everyone else's or different, I think we should find out.
Let me see what it looks like. Gary from Malvern has to say. Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Gary. Go ahead. You're on the air. We don't seem to have Gary. Let me ask you, and this... this gets us to, a deeper discussion about guns and the kind of guns that this young man apparently had access to. The fact that he had high-capacity magazines and apparently as much as 30 clips in a mag, or 30 bullets, I should say, in a magazine, with more. It looks like if the police hadn't entered the building, he might have even discharged more. Do you think it's time, Stephen, to limit clips? Number of bullets people can get their hands on?
I think there's no question in my mind that it's time to do that. Again, if you think about if it was a revolver that was a single shot, there would have been far fewer deaths. There might have been some, but far fewer and much more protection available. So I don't think there's any question that would be one of the first things I would like to see happen.
What about for you, Dorothy?
I mean, maybe that's the route to go. We didn't have very much success with trying to limit the number of guns you can purchase per month. With that legislation, it kind of, you know, didn't go very far. It didn't go anywhere, in fact. So maybe the ammunition and that piece is...
Let me quote something. This was in the New York Times. I don't know if it was today or yesterday. The headline is, "In a town at ease with its firearms, tightening gun rules was resisted." And it's about the people, and I'm quoting here, "In the rural hilly areas around Newtown, Connecticut, are used to gunfire," talking about the fact that there were some ranges there that people would use. And then I'm quoting here, "But in the last couple of years, residents began noticing loud, repeated gunfire and even explosions coming from new places near a trailer park, by a boat launch, next to well-appointed houses." And then goes on to say that there are these informal, I'm not going to call them illegal, but informal gun ranges, and it looks like gun ranges used by people that like to use these semi-automatic weapons, and even a bit of a fight between the traditional hunters and discreet gun owners, as they're described, and those people who were assault weapon enthusiasts. Is the problem, do you think, Joel, assault weapons and the kind of psychology that goes with them?
I think the problem is that the discussion has been irrational, that if we really think about how to protect ourselves as a country, it's not an all or nothing issue, but it's a matter of thinking about rational. I should not be able to go out and get a bazooka. You know, that there's only one reason for me to have a bazooka, I feel, in that sense. It's to hurt large amounts of people. And yet, I do want to appreciate that there is a sport involved and there is hunting and all the things that are important to people and target practice. That's the responsible use of guns, but there's no discussion about the middle here, which I think majority of Americans really do support. It's because everything in our country right now has become so polarized because of the concerns of slippery slopes. So for me, I think that the best thing that can happen from this is that we actually start a discussion about what is rational and have people's choices not fully compromised, but I think that the choices have to be understood in the context of the devastation that's happening in our cities and our country.
I was looking at some stuff over the weekend, 5 gun safety regulations that even NRA members could support, requiring criminal background checks on gun owners and gun shop employees, prohibiting terrorist watch list members from acquiring guns, mandating the gun owners tell the police when their gun is stolen, a concealed carry permit should be restricted to individuals who have completed a safety training course, concealed carry permits shouldn't be given to perpetrators of violent misdemeanors or individuals. I mean, these don't seem, as you see, these seem kind of common sense. Is that a good place to start?
I think that's a great place to start. And I think that, you know, it has to come from the top, but it has to include everybody in the conversation.
Does that make sense to you, Dorothy?
It does make sense. But what doesn't make sense to me is why people, and as you said, maybe the majority of folks are, you know, on board with those kinds of rational conversations, but there are many who feel that it's okay to buy 10 guns a month, or that there's something wrong that I would have to report my gun lost or stolen if it was lost or stolen. And I don't understand that, because anything that's, if your automobile is lost or stolen, you report it. So any conversations that don't support that, I don't get. And there have been conversations across at least Pennsylvania where they don't want to talk about reporting a gun lost or stolen. They don't want to talk about limiting the number of handguns that you can purchase per month. Why would someone need to purchase 10 handguns a month? You know, I don't get that.
Let me go back to you, Stephen. And again, this is trying to understand the thinking of someone that commits mass murder. But do you think, bottom line, whether it's rational or irrational, that there's some kind of grievance involved?
Well, typically somebody who does this feels some sense that they've been slighted. Again, when you have a psychiatric issue or disorder, you're much more likely to see that as personal, to take things that were not personal as personal, and to feel justified in your actions because you're irrational. You're not thinking straight. So usually there's some grievance, but it, you know, 10 people may look at it and go, what was that? That was, that was a normal event in the day. And that's, again, that combination that Joel talked about that's so toxic, which is, mental health issues and access to these kind of weapons.
But clearly, even someone that fits the profile of this young man wouldn't necessarily, pick up a gun.
No, 99% of them would not. Right. That's absolutely the case. The problem is the 1%, and we know that.
What do you hope the president does? I mean, he, last night speaking, I'm looking at you, Joel, but speaking at this vigil, he didn't go into specifics, but he kind of said, enough already. So he's been criticized for not doing enough.
Right. I think that we discussed today a lot of the things that may be lacking. Everything from the discussion we just mentioned to mental health and help in that area to understanding, actually on a broader level, the trauma that is being experienced in this wonderful town is being experienced every day in our cities. And that that is, it is a cycle of violence that Steve was talking about. I think that in a sense, it's rational to arm yourself. If I would never do it, and I don't think that it is a good thing, but the perception in our communities is that if you're unsafe, you need to protect yourself. And Dorothy talked about protecting your children. Mm-hmm. The problem is that we have to really create a culture of safety in our communities that is beyond just a one single law or one single healthcare plan. It's attention being paid to the people who are speaking out loudly.
I'm going to give you the last words, Dorothy. Go ahead.
I agree, and it is truly a public health issue nationally. We didn't hear much about gun control, gun law, sensible laws, or anything like that during the campaign.
Almost nothing.
Nothing. I think we need to have more serious conversations on public health, violence being a public health issue, and also looking at the mental health piece, the assault weapons and all of that, but in a way that it becomes a national platform, that it's not just in Connecticut that we're looking at that, but across this country. In Chicago, the president's hometown, there are over 400 murders already this year. In Philadelphia, there are over 300 murders here in Philadelphia. Now, granted, they weren't our children, but they were somebody's child.
Yes.
So we need to begin to have serious conversations, mental health, violence as a mental health issue, looking at the availability of guns and in the wrong hands. And seriously, how do we begin to heal these families that are harmed and communities that are harmed as a result of violence?
My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Dorothy Johnson Spy Day, licensed family therapist, founder of Mothers in Charge. She gave me something that Mothers in Charge is presenting, the We Remember Them, An Evening of Healing, Thursday, December 27th, just I guess next week at 5:30. And for more information, go to 215 or dial 215-228-1718. Joel Fine, thank you very much as well. Professor of Pediatrics Emergency Medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Also an attending physician at the Emergency Department at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Stephen Berkowitz, thank you very much as well. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist and associate professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. Also director of the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response Recovery. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find much more about this program. We started a conversation on our Facebook page yesterday, probably something that there today as well. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Time. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back. And coming up next, another tragedy halfway around the world, a garment factory fire in Bangladesh that killed